Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information at carthage.edu/grad. Support also comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Jack Andrea, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm so happy to welcome back into our studios Jessica DeBoer, a good friend of the morning show, a good friend to many of you, and particularly for many of you who have taken in the many and varied joys that are part of the Fine Arts at First series at First United Methodist Church in Kenosha on the corner of Sheridan Road and 60th Street. And this is a series that is offered up to the community in a sense as a gift. These concerts are free of charge, and they offer up really first-rate musical entertainment of one kind or another. And Jessica's here for part one of today's morning show to talk about this upcoming season, which is about to begin on Sunday afternoon.
That's correct.
So first of all, Jessica DeBoer, we welcome you back to the morning show. It's really good to have you here. I know that life is interesting for you with settling into a new home and so on. So I have a feeling for you, the start of this new Fine Arts at First series is maybe a little more harried than usual.
Yeah, life's been a little crazy for me right now. But it's good to be back in the routine of the school year and the season. And we're looking forward to getting started this Sunday at 3 o'clock.
And it probably makes sense that over the years there has been such a emphasis on great pianists playing great piano music, since one of the jewels of that lovely sanctuary at First United Methodist Church is that extraordinary grand piano. Just say a word about that before we talk about Sunday afternoon's pianist.
Absolutely. We are blessed in our congregation to be the caretakers of a 9-foot 2-inch Bursendorfer concert grand piano. It is probably the biggest and best piano in Kenosha. I know there are people who will debate me on that one, but I'm going to say for now it's the best piano in town, and we are very proud to be its caretakers, and we take good care of it. We just had it refurbished this summer, so it's in top performance mode right now, and it was a gift to our congregation, and we began our concert series in 2005 because of this gift, and we thought, we can't just play this on Sunday mornings for services. We need to share it with the community, and that's the main reason why Fine Arts at First got started.
Right. It is a gorgeous piano. It's probably the best piano, not just in town, but even in maybe this corner of the state.
That's possible, for sure.
It's really an exceptional instrument, absolutely amazing, particularly in terms of its size and its beauty. And it's just amazing, and you guys have taken great care of it. So it makes all the sense in the world to begin a concert series like this with a piano recital. So tell us about the talented pianist who is going to be part of Sunday afternoon's concert.
Yeah, I like to try to start every season with piano, just because that's kind of where we started. So this Sunday at 3 o'clock, we're bringing in Ross Salvosa, and he is on the piano faculty at the Chopin Academy of Music in Issaquah, Washington. He's also the chairman and the artistic director of Music Without Borders Society in Vancouver, British Columbia. So, yep, he's from a faraway place from Wisconsin, but he is friends with Flora Lim, who is one of the best piano teachers in the area, and she's brought him here in the past for master classes, and so now he's going to come and give a recital on Sundays to kick off our season.
So has he filled you in on what repertoire he's going to be playing?
Yes, he's going to be doing a nice, you know, it's kind of a walk through piano music. We've got, it's going to start with Bach, also include Chopin. I don't think it's legal to have a piano recital without some Chopin on it. I think that's part required by law, right?
But then
also some Brahms, Ravel, and Ginastera. So it kind of goes from the, you know, beginning of piano music, you know, up until the 20th century. So it'll be a really great overview of some wonderful works.
Absolutely. That's great. And I have to say that not only is the actual Bursendorfer concert grand a wonderful instrument, but that's a beautiful room in which to hear piano music.
Yep.
I love that the acoustic is generous, and yet it's not so reverberant that things kind of turn soupy.
Muddy,
and,
yep.
Yeah, and on the other hand, it's not a kind of a dry, arid acoustic. It seems, I'm no expert, but it sure seems like it's just about the perfect room in which to place a beautiful grand piano and then to have it played by someone who's a real virtuoso.
Yes, absolutely. Something else that Ross is really, that is part of his job is that he is a teacher. And he also does master classes. And so as part of that, we're having a master class tomorrow.
Oh.
As part of his visit, he's giving a master class tomorrow at 10 o'clock in the morning at First United Methodist in the sanctuary. And for those of you who don't know, a master class is when a teacher listens to a bunch of students who are taught by someone else, and he gives them his ideas of what they can do to improve and make their playing better, you know, not only technique-wise, but for each particular piece that they perform. So it's a nice chance for students to get input from a different teacher.
Mm-hmm.
So and it's nice for teachers because then a lot of times the person giving the masterclass says the exact same things that they always say in their lessons, and the students go, "Oh, okay, my teacher isn't crazy.
Absolutely.
I guess they're saying the right thing."
Right, and sometimes the light bulb goes on.
Absolutely.
Because someone has said pretty much the same thing, but said it in a different way, and it starts to make greater sense. Yeah, that's a nice opportunity. And is that open to the public?
It is open to the public. So, you know, you can come and see how piano lessons work in a way, and just if you're a teacher or a student, and even if you're not performing, you can come and just hear some great input about pieces and performing and technique and just, you know, get some great ideas that
Fantastic.
Way.
So that's tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock.
Tomorrow morning at 10.
And then Sunday's wide-ranging piano recital at First United Methodist Church will be at 3 o'clock.
3 o'clock.
And just about everything you do is at 3 o'clock Sunday afternoon, right?
Just about. The only thing that's not is Messiah, and we'll get to that. But yeah, everything's at 3 o'clock free. And the doors to the sanctuary open at 2:30. So you can, if you want to come and make sure you get a good parking space, you can do that and then sit in our great room until the doors open. There's plenty of room for everybody to just wait and then go in.
Fantastic. Okay, so what is the next offering?
The next concert is November 5th, and we are bringing the Bell Ensemble to...
Ah.
Yeah, I know you know the Bell Ensemble. So November 5th, the Bell Ensemble, and they are doing a concert titled Musical Mystics Spanning the Atlantic. And it's for those of you who don't know, the Bell Ensemble is a small choral group. They do chamber music, and they do unique pieces, I believe. That's part of their mission, that they do pieces that are not typically performed.
Right. They uncover some real rarities.
Yes. And actually, I play the viola, and I had a chance to play in a concert with them last March, and it was a really fantastic concert. And it's just pieces I'd never heard of, and it was a great opportunity to play them. So they do a lot of unique pieces. And so they're doing a concert featuring the music of Samuel Barber, who's an American composer, and also Benjamin Britten, who's a British composer. And they both lived at about the same time, and they were both born in the early 20th century and died in the early 80s, late 70s, early 80s. And so they're doing some of their small religious-based works. Yeah. And so, you know, they're doing Barber's Hermit Songs. They're doing the Hymn to St. Cecilia by Britten, and just other small little chamber works that you might not hear otherwise.
Right. Very good. I am acquainted with the Bell Ensemble for a couple reasons, and one of them is that their artistic director and creator, Nick Berutian, is a longtime former voice student of mine. So I know Nick very, very well. He's a consummate musician, and I think he's done absolutely amazing things with the Bell Ensemble in terms of giving some of our best area vocalists these kind of opportunities. And it's really been neat to see what he's done. And this sounds like a really beautiful offering on
Sunday afternoon,
November 5th.
Yes.
Very good. After that,
it's Christmas, and we all know what happens at Christmas for Fine Arts at First. December 17 is our 13th annual, because this is our 13th season, so our 13th annual Sing-Along Messiah, and that takes place at 6 p.m. on December 17, and that is our flagship concert every year, and it's just really, it's my favorite concert of the year. And I know that I say that every year, but it really is true. And I have just emailed all the orchestra people to invite them to come play. And that has been the reply every time. Oh, it's my favorite concert. I can't wait. Sign me up. So, you know, we do most of the Christmas portion of the Messiah and some of the Easter portion as well. Just a few numbers from there. Of course, the Hallelujah Chorus. And of course, Greg is our fearless leader for that every year. And we're just so grateful that he is willing to do that every year. So it's something that we always look forward to.
It's a pleasure, and I am excited about that. I guess I'm a little shaken that it's the 13th.
I know, so I can't believe it.
I hope it's not an unlucky night.
It won't be. It'll be great. It'll be
earthquake
perfect. No.
Blizzard or anything.
No, don't say that.
Okay. Don't even joke about that.
No, it's not funny.
We've actually on a time or two run into some nasty weather.
Yes, last year it was very cold.
Right, and we've battled sometimes heavy snow, but it's never been canceled.
Nope.
It always goes on one way or another. Although I remember one year we had to switch sopranos at the last minute because our soprano soloist was up in. I can't remember now, Marshfield
or Watertown, someplace.
Was impossible for her to get down to Kenosha. And fortunately, Jennifer Hansen was willing to zoom in for the rescue, and all was well with the world. It's actually interesting, even when it's a wintry night, it's incredible how many people often will still make their way through the elements to be part of it.
It really is a major part of some people's Christmas traditions. They'll come up to me after the performance and say, oh, I'm so glad you didn't cancel because this is so important to my Christmas traditions and I have to come. And so it's a really great concert.
And we should probably make it clear what's meant by this term sing-along Messiah.
Right. A lot of the pieces in Messiah, well, there's two kinds of pieces. There are recitatives or solos that are done by the soloist that you bring in. But then there are choral pieces, and those choir pieces are sung not by a choir that we hire or feature, but by the audience members. And so everybody sits in their vocal section. We have the sopranos over here and the tenors over there. And then when it gets to the chorus, Greg will turn around and start conducting everybody to sing. Now, but that doesn't mean that you have to sing. So don't be afraid of that. You know, I always tell people, you don't have to sing. It's not a requirement. You can just come and listen. So, you know, if you don't like to sing, that's okay. You can just listen. But if you like to sing, then you should come and join your voice with everyone else's.
Absolutely. So that is Sunday evening, December 17th.
That's right.
6 p.m. at First United Methodist Church. For those of you just joining us, Jessica DeBoer is my guest for this first part of the morning show. And we're talking about this season of Fine Arts at First United Methodist Church on the corner of Sheridan Road and 60th Street. The season begins this Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock with a piano recital by Ross Salvoza. The Bell Ensemble is on November 5th, and the aforementioned Sing-Along Messiah is on Sunday night, December 17th. As we flip into 2018, what fills out the season?
So the Messiah is the halfway point, and then once we get to 2018, February 11, we are bringing back Frank Almond. And he was here a couple years ago, and we were packed to the gills with people in the audience, and it was such an incredible concert. So this time he is bringing his group called Frankly Music, which is his chamber music group, and they have about 20 different musicians on staff. That's not the right word, but, you know, that they draw from about 20 different on call, exactly, so that they can do all sorts of chamber pieces in all different combinations, you know.
That's exactly how the Bell Ensemble operates, by the way. It's not a fixed set of particular singers.
And also the Fifth House Ensemble, which we've had several times at Fine Arts at First. But Frankly Music, they're doing a concert called Check It Out, and not check like the word you would think, but check like Czech Republic, C-Z-E-C-H, Check It Out. Yeah, right. Kind of a play on words. Uh-huh. And so they're doing all music by Czech composers, Bohuslav Martinů, Leos Janáček, and also Antonín Dvořák, so the big three Czech composers. And so it'll be Frank on violin, but also friends playing cello and piano. So they're doing some interesting combinations. They'll do a violin and cello piece. They're going to do a cello and piano piece, violin and piano. But then all together, they'll do the Dumky Trio by Dvorak, which is one of his major chamber works.
That's
cool.
It's an
incredible piece of music.
And we should really clarify for people that Frank Almond is the concertmaster of the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra.
Yes.
I mean, he is one of the preeminent violinists, really, in this part of the country, and such a great guy.
Yeah,
so wonderful to work
with.
Yeah,
and he's so, you know, here we are in Little Kenosha, and he's like, yeah, sure. And he came 2 or 3 years ago, and he just said he had a lot of fun and he would be happy to come back. So I was really grateful for that. So,
oh, that's great to hear.
Yeah,
I'm sure many, many people will look forward to the opportunity to experience his beautiful, beautiful artistry once again.
Yes, and with some of his friends.
Absolutely. Terrific. So that's Sunday afternoon, February 11th, Frank Almond with his chamber group called Frankly Music, and in a program devoted to the music of several of the best Czech composers in history. After that
is March 18, and we are bringing the Merling Trio, which is a standard piano trio, and that means that it is violin, cello, and piano, which is, you know, there's a ton of pieces written for that ensemble. But the Merling Trio comes from Western Michigan University, and which is kind of close to my stomping grounds where I grew up and went to school. And, you know, I don't know how I got connected with the gal who is the sort of the manager of the group, and she heard about me, we've just been trying for years to get them over here, and it's finally worked out. So they're going to come March 18, and they're doing a program. They're doing a project, the Great American Songbook Project. And, you know, in the past, I don't know, decade or so, these tunes have become really popular. Vocalists that you wouldn't think of have been doing these compilations of doing songs from the American Songbook. And so now this piano trio is going to be doing tunes by Gershwin, Ellington, Henry Mancini. And so it'll be really interesting because, you know, there's so many piano trios. I mean, Haydn wrote them, Mozart, Beethoven, all the great composers wrote piano trios. But instead of playing typical piano trios, we're going to be hearing Great American Songbook tunes.
Wow.
So I thought that was, you know, really interesting. And there's been this movement in the piano trio world, I think, in the last 20 years or so to, you know, have these different kind of arrangements done.
Hmm. That's a neat idea.
Yeah.
I remember it was actually, I think, a performance of a trio that came to Carthage for our chamber music series a few years back that a member of one of those groups I interviewed really clarified it for me, that what makes a piano trio so fantastic and different from, for instance, a string quartet is that because you have a piano kind of laying out the foundation of everything, that allows the cello and the violin to play much more like soloists.
Sure, absolutely.
They aren't like a string quartet where they are sort of busy filling in all the chords and creating the texture. They can be just as flamboyant and freewheeling as a soloist in terms of the music that's composed for them. And I'd never really stopped to think about, oh, yes, that's why piano trios sound different than string quartets. Not that they're better or worse, but it's just it's a very distinct kind of chamber music making.
Yes.
And I can see how that would work just marvelously for repertoire like this.
Absolutely. And that is such a great observation. When a string quartet, you always have someone playing the melody and everyone kind of backing them up. But
there's certain sort of a concision and a precision about how everybody works together. It's like this finely oiled machine.
Right.
And I mean, an amazing.
Yes.
But a piano trio,
you really
feels
have three
different
soloists working together.
Yeah, yep. Absolutely.
That's
so,
that's
going to work well there for that. So that's the Merling Trio on March 18th, and again, it won't be Haydn and Mozart. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but playing music of America's great songbook. What a terrific idea! Does that bring us to the finale of the series?
The finale of the season, May 6th, and of course, our finale is always our Fine Arts Jazz Ensemble. It's led by Mike Gudbauer on bass, and he puts together an incredible group every year. Brian Harris on piano. Now, I haven't gotten the final personnel list for this year, but every other year it's been Brian Harris on piano, Paul Griffin on drums, Tim Bell, Tom Meredith, Ken Wheely Jr., Steve Jacobs, Sue Crawford, just the best of the best in the Kenosha
Racine area. The all-stars.
Well, yeah, they're fantastic. And so this year's theme is Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, Getting to the Gig.
Yeah.
So it's going to be tunes that are all about transportation, Come Fly With Me, Night Train, Slow Boat to China. So anything you can think of, it'll be tunes that deal with transportation. And Mike has a great thing going. every other year, you know, we sort of go back and forth. One year we'll feature a specific person from jazz. So like last year we did Vince Guaraldi.
Mm-hmm.
And then the opposite year he'll do a theme concert. We've done, you know, jazz across all the seasons, you know, and now we have jazz for transportation. So
that's really neat.
Yeah, it's
and
a lot of fun.
And if people don't happen to know, Mike Goodbar doesn't live here anymore.
No.
He used to live right here,
that's
but
right.
he loves fine arts at first and still wants to do this.
Yep. And he comes from North Carolina every year to do it. So
I mean, that's,
it's awesome. And I keep saying, are you sure you want to come? Are you sure? I understand you're so far. He's like, no, let's do it. So
right.
I'm so grateful because he puts together such an incredible concert every year.
Yeah, great guy, great musician. And I know all kinds of people look forward to this year after year.
Yep.
What a fantastic series this is.
I'm excited, yes.
Yeah, with
absolutely.
Good reason. So which season is this?
This is our 13th season.
Oh, okay. So it's 13th Sing Along Messiah and 13th Fine Arts at First series.
That's right.
Wow, I would not have guessed it had been quite that long.
I know, I can't believe it. It's been quite a wild ride.
Time flies
it
when
does.
You're having fun, and this is bringing a lot of fun to the area, and really, really great music and musicians as well. So, as we mentioned earlier, these performances are all free, at least in the sense that there is no admission charge.
There is no admission.
It's not that they don't cost somebody some money.
They do, yes. Yes, they do. But there is no admission. There's no tickets. You don't have to buy tickets. You don't have to have tickets. You just show up and get a program and have a seat and enjoy the concert.
Wow. Well, it's so good of First United Methodist Church to do this for the community. I mean, that's no small matter. It's no small feat.
That's right. And we are very glad to do it. It's really our mission to have this outreach to our community.
Wow. Fantastic. So the newest Fine Arts at First series gets underway this Sunday afternoon with concert pianist Ross Salvoza, 3 o'clock Sunday afternoon, playing the stunningly beautiful Busendorfer grand piano in the sanctuary, First United Methodist Church, corner of Sheridan Road and 60th Street. And again, admission is free. So all you have to do is show up and prepare to be dazzled by a great musician playing great music. And at the helm of it all, Jessica DeBoer, the coordinator for the Fine Arts at First season. Jessica, it's always great to talk to you. Congrats again on putting together yet another marvelous concert season.
Thank you so much.
It's 8:33, and you're listening to the Morning Show on WGTD HD, and here is part two of today's program. If you look at a book called Unlikely Loves, you will see a photograph on that cover that tells the story of this unlikely book and the wonderful unlikely stories that are captured in its pages. We see a picture of a beautiful dog. It looks like a golden retriever. And nestled right next to it, appearing to be very, very affectionate indeed, is what appears to be perhaps a leopard or cheetah. And these two animals have come to know each other and come to be, it would seem, friends. And it is one of just a number of stories that are told in this wonderful book. Its predecessor was called Unlikely Friendships. This book, again, is called Unlikely Loves. And the author of the book is Jennifer S. Holland. And Jennifer Holland is a contributing writer for National Geographic. And she has experienced plenty of these unlikely friendships and love affairs of her own. And so she is well equipped to help us understand how such relationships across species can be possible. And there's plenty of photographic evidence to back up all that she describes in these various stories. 43 of them in Unlikely Loves, which is published by Workman Publishing. And Jennifer S. Holland, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Before we talk specifically about the book, I wonder if you would just say a word about where your love of the outdoors and wildlife comes from. And ultimately how that took you to the National Geographic Society.
Yes, absolutely. Well, I think my love of animals, basically all creatures, comes from my mom. She was a huge animal lover, and we always had many animals in our household, and so I just came to feel that they were an important part of my life. And the outdoors part, I think, is just my own thing. I've just always felt at home in nature, and the wilder the better. And the idea of being out in nature with wild animals and actually seeing them do what they naturally do is something that I just really, really enjoy. Mm.
So how did you find your way to the National Geographic Society?
You know, it was kind of a dream of mine from way back. I initially, as a child, wanted to be a photographer, but the writing was just more my speed and my talent. And so when I had an opportunity to meet people there and to speak to them, and I did what we call an informational interview, where you go and just talk to people about their work, and that often opens up a door into an organization. And so eventually I made my way into the television side and worked in TV for a little while, and then found my way to the magazine, which is where I really wanted to be.
Hmm. I was really excited to see the first of your books, Unlikely Friendships. It is a book which my young niece, Lorelai, has very much enjoyed. So when I came to their house the other day with this book, Unlikely Loves, I thought I was going to be unveiling for her. I just wanted her to take a look at it. It's the kind of thing I knew she would love. I had no idea that she already owned Unlikely Friendships. And so they ran to the shelf to grab that book. And so it's been my opportunity to see that for the very first time. And then, of course, we explore today the more recent book, which is called Unlikely Loves. One point that you make, I think, in the preface to the second book is that there are probably plenty of people who might be hesitant to attach words like friendship or love to anything or anyone in the animal kingdom, that those are qualities that are best reserved for interaction between two human beings, or at the very least, a relationship where at least one of the partners is a human being. But the idea that two animals can enjoy friendship or enjoy love, that's just something that plenty of people might be hesitant to do. And obviously you realize that and acknowledge that freely in the preface. Tell us more about what draws you to use that kind of terminology in talking about this remarkable sense of connectedness that is right there before us. There's no question that something's there. Why do you choose to call it friendships or love?
It's, you know, it is an interesting phenomenon, the language aspect of this. And I think, you know, I use these words fairly playfully in the book, certainly love especially. I think friendship is a little bit easier to understand in animals. But I think, you know, it used to be very, very taboo to associate any kind of human-like emotions to with other animals. And that's really changed a lot. There are more and more animal behaviorists and biologists who are looking at other mammals and trying to understand their brain function and what they're capable of, and are seeing a real capability for empathy, for, you know, emotions that resemble very, very much some of the emotions that we have. We share a lot of the same brain parts that have to do with, you know, the center of emotion in the brain. Recently someone did some MRI studies where they showed that the part of the brain, I think it's called the caudal nucleus in dogs, lights up just the same way that a human caudal nucleus lights up when something positive is happening. And so I think it's less and less taboo to talk about that. Again, love is a tough word because it really is very much a human term. But I think loving relationships, there is a need for companionship among these animals. There is an affection that is clear to see, and I think I'm pretty comfortable at least giving animals the benefit of the doubt that they're capable of empathy and capable of caring.
Mm. So how did this begin? Did you see a particular unlikely friendship between two different animals, and did that set you on this journey, or did you already first wonder about such a thing and in a sense go searching for it? I mean, did this fall into your lap, or is this something you set out to discover?
I'd say it was a combination of the two. I was very, very fortunate that my publisher, Workman Publishing in New York, had gotten in touch with me at National Geographic to see if I wanted to work with them on an animal book, because they liked the coverage I was doing for the magazine. And this subject was of mutual interest. You know, there's so many of these cute pictures floating around on the web. I'm always getting in my inbox, you know, the adorable little stories. But I was curious whether there was truth behind these images or whether these were really photoshopped kinds of things that people were just sending around. And the more I looked into it, the more I realized that there, you know, there were many, many incidents that were absolutely real. And even cases which, you know, a dog actually lactating in order to feed kittens. That's one of the stories in the new book. The mutt was not, you know, had not just given birth. She was not in the lactating time of her life, and yet it happened when she had these kittens come up to her and want to feed. So I think there's, you know, there are a lot of ways these things happen and reasons that animals come together. But no matter what, they seem to offer us a little hope, and they really just show a different side of animals than the kind of wilder, you know, mercilessness of nature that that we often see on the predator-prey television shows.
Mm, like that. That's for sure. and it's interesting how, I guess, one of the things I didn't even expect was how differently I would see some of these animals just by seeing them beside another animal. That there's something about that you end up noticing all kinds of details that would just sort of swim past you. Maybe one of the best examples I can think of is in one of my favorite chapters in Unlikely Loves, where it's titled "The Piglet and the Rottweiler," and the photograph that is at the head of that short little chapter is of three Rottweiler puppies sleeping. And nestled right amongst them in the third slot, instead of another Rottweiler puppy, it's a tiny little piglet, almost exactly the same size, eyes closed, appearing to sleep just like these three puppies nestled around it. And I just find myself drawn to every possible detail of that piglet precisely because it doesn't fit. And I found it really remarkable. I wonder if you've had kind of that similar experience, even as someone who knows the animal kingdom a lot better than most of us do, that you're seeing these animals differently because of these unlikely settings.
I think so, actually. That's a very good point. There's this contrast in the images that just really makes that interloper stand out, and it does make you kind of see it in a different light, maybe see the details more clearly than you would have. And it also, you know, in terms of seeing in another light, I think just that combination when you don't expect it maybe just, you know, brings forth a different feeling about the animal. Something like a pig. Some people, not a lot of interest in pigs, not particularly impressed by them, but they're actually incredibly intelligent animals. They may wallow around in the mud, but I guess they have good reason to do that. And to see them in this other context just kind of, you know, gives you a different perspective, I think.
Hmm. So tell us how you have come to know about these various unlikely friendships and unlikely loves between animals. Some of these people, we get the feeling that these are people that you already know one way or another, people that oversee various animal sanctuaries and so on. And then in other cases, the impression is that these are people you otherwise would not know at all, except for the fact of these unlikely animal combinations. So kind of tell us the logistics by which you were able to gather these more than 80 stories.
Sure. It started really with finding photographs of pairs and then doing the research to find out what is the story behind this photo. Is there really something going on here, or was this just kind of a moment in time that looks like more than it is? Also, I was in touch, as you say, with a lot of wildlife sanctuaries and zoos and contacts that I might have made during my time at National Geographic, because these facilities that bring in wild animals often have combinations, you know, have animals that can romp around together. And so sometimes these friendships do occur under those circumstances. And my friends and family and everybody I knew after the first book, of course, whenever they would see a story like this, would immediately send it to me and so that I could research it and include it. So they came from all over the place, all over the world. And in some cases, I got to meet people, as you say, who I would have never otherwise met. For example, a woman in a very tiny village in Poland who has the blind boxer and the goose that get together. I had to have a translator to reach out to her, and we communicated by snail mail first because she didn't have an email address. And it was really just a really fun and interesting investigative process.
A couple of the chapters are just a little bit out of the ordinary. I mean, a little bit different from the standard stories, which are of two very different animals that somehow have become friends. But then there's one really intriguing story, which is of the lioness and the lioness. And at the very first glance, you think, why is this here? What is unlikely about this? And, of course, then we start reading and then we start thinking and we realize that this is actually quite unlikely. Tell our listeners about the lioness and the lioness.
Sure. Well, lionesses in general, unless they are related in the same pride, they do not get along at all. It is a competition to have another girl around. And so you're not going to see two unrelated female lions in any sort of compassionate relationship normally. But these two were, each had very interesting histories, which I tell a little bit about in the book, but they were ultimately brought together through the Born Free Foundation in South Africa. And one of them really came to not only like the other, but became jealous when the other was showing any kind of affection or even just attention to other animals at the facility. And so it's a very bizarre sort of interesting matchup, and I just thought because it's so unlikely that this would ever happen in a wild setting, it just fit right in with the theme.
Explain to our listeners how these friendships tend to take place. That is, how often it is completely by accident versus how often it is a little bit more by design. Not in the sense that, you know, somebody's anxious to get their unlikely animal pair into your book. I don't mean that for the sake of publicity, but often it is because of very specific circumstances that two different animals find themselves, in a sense, sort of thrust together and establish a connection that we wouldn't otherwise expect to see.
That's right. In some cases, at some of the wildlife facilities, if an animal isn't thriving, there may be an attempt to bring in another animal in order to improve the first animal's health. And because this companionship is a mammalian thing, it's not just a people thing. And so if an animal is not doing very well, maybe it's not eating, maybe it lost its parent or lost its baby and it's struggling, having another animal companion can really bring out can improve the life of that first animal that's feeling sort of lost. And so there are cases of that. There's also cases of literally using an animal as a surrogate to take over and adopt another animal that needs to feed and needs a parental figure. And in captivity, as I always say, the animals are well cared for. They aren't fighting for food. They don't have to compete. And so certainly you'll see more of the luxury of being able to cross species lines and just find a buddy on the property. Whereas in the wild, it's more complicating, and I think sometimes it's an animal that maybe has lost its family and is not quite sure what it's supposed to do, hasn't maybe developed fully, and so might pair up with an animal, even a prey or predator, not knowing that it's not supposed to do that. And sometimes that just works.
I think one thing that's very interesting is that on the surface, this is a beautiful, idyllic book about one heartwarming story after another. And really, every single story on some level is heartwarming. But there is one particular chapter of a story set actually in Thailand that begins this way. This next story is not for the faint of heart, but I promise it has a happier ending than a beginning.
Yes.
Do you remember what story I'm talking about?
I do. That is Boon Lua, the macaque. This poor creature was attacked by wild dogs, or I should say feral dogs, and literally ripped to pieces. Lost, I think, three limbs, if I remember correctly, and somehow dragged itself to a temple in Thailand, and the monks working there got a vet to come, and they saved this animal, and ultimately paired it up with a rabbit and a guinea pig. And again, this was a case where an animal that probably would have died normally has a troop of, others around it needed companions, and these other species fulfilled that role, and the macaque survived and did quite well.
Hmm. I also want to ask you about the beautiful pair that adorns your the cover of your book, this leopard and what appears to be a golden retriever, and it's a lovely photograph, and I think the story that accompanies them is lovely as well.
Yeah, this is I love to see these. There's interesting stories with cheetahs also that appear in the first book, but this one is a leopard, and this was another case of an animal that was brought in to be hand raised. It was an orphan, and just kind of found this dog to be a best friend, literally. I mean, I don't think there's any other way to say it. They just became playmates. They took walks together. They slept together. And even when the cat was separated from the dog to give it more space to be a leopard, they would still come back together and spend time together and play together in the grass. And it just was almost like an old married couple, I think, just spending time together side by side. And it's really quite lovely.
And at some point towards the end of the story, you write words to the effect that someday it may be that they are not as important to each other as they once were, as this cheetah continues to grow up into full adulthood and then presumably forms standard relationships with other leopards, but that almost certainly something is going to remain of this unlikely friendship between these two.
Yeah, I think, and dogs and elephants and certain other animals we know really do have very good memories and remember companions from the past, and big cats also are known to do that. So I think that it wouldn't be surprising if many years went by and the animals were reintroduced and if they remembered each other.
Hmm. Could we take a moment and talk about the photographs, which are such an important part of this book? First of all, who's responsible for the photographs?
I wish I could take credit myself, but they come from all of the sources who told me the stories. Most of them, either there was a wonderful news photos taken at the time when the incident happened and the people were able to share those. Some of them, the people took their own pictures of their animals. And in a few cases, we had photographs taken of the animals. But mostly they come from all over the place. Everybody's getting really good at taking very good digital photos these days. So I was really lucky to have access to that.
And the photographs really are wonderful. The vast majority of are absolutely first-rate technical quality. There are a handful that are a little more sort of ordinary, homemade-looking photographs, but even those, in a sense, kind of confirm the reality of all this, that none of this has anything to do with trickery with Photoshop or anything else. These are absolute stories, absolutely real, and in many cases, amazing. We have time for a couple of more stories. Why don't you choose a couple of your favorites that we have not yet talked about?
Sure. I love the story of the dolphin that joins up with the sperm whales, in part because it happened in the wild and was captured by scientists who were in the area working on a marine mammal project. But this was a bottlenose dolphin that looked to have some sort of spinal injury or maybe a birth defect. And possibly it was either left behind by its own pod or couldn't keep up or something. We don't really know why. but it joined up with the sperm whales, and the whales completely accepted it as part of the group. And it actually even was acting more like a sperm whale than a dolphin. It was, you know, hanging out where they hang out in the water, and brushing up against them in the way that sperm whales do. And it's just a really fascinating case, I think, of what can happen in the wild under strange circumstances. So that is definitely one of my favorites. And I also love throwing in a couple of people stories, and there's a terrific story of a girl who helped to raise a moose that had been injured and taken in Alaska. And she and the moose clearly had a very, very strong bond, and she's able to go back and visit it on a regular basis, and it always remembers her and is always very, very happy to see her.
One wonderful story after another. What is ultimately the point of this book? I mean, what purpose does it serve beyond just sort of the warm, tingling feeling it gives us and sometimes a sense of kind of amusement? I suspect that somewhere behind all of this is an important point that you think is being made.
Yeah. Well, I think the amusement part is a good part, too, because I think we all need a little bit of that. And just stories of hope, I think, are desperately needed right now in the world. And so a whole couple of books of those are I think, good for people. But also there is the obvious message of kind of kindness across the line. And you know, just because these animals are different species, they're able to communicate in some way and to have a positive companionship. And I think, you know, we need that, and we should send this off to Congress, I think, and to all the other all the heads of state and around the world to remember that what's most important is to be good to each other and to cooperate.
This newest book, again, is called Unlikely Loves. The book before it, Unlikely Friendships, both published by Workman Publishing, and the author, Jennifer S. Holland. Jennifer S. Holland, I so enjoyed this opportunity to speak with you about both of these beautiful books. Very best wishes to you.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Monday on the morning show, best-selling novelist Ralph Peters talking about his latest book, which is called Judgment at Appomattox, set in the final days of the American Civil War, a truly remarkable book. Tuesday, we'll talk about another remarkable book, Time Travel by Daniel Glick, in which he examines how human beings over the millennia have viewed time, and in particular, the way in which people have thought about the future. And where we are headed. He culminates with an examination of H.E. Wells's The Time Machine. In part two, we'll be previewing for you the upcoming historic tour of the Preservation Racine Group. Wednesday, Art Sear joins us from Carthage College to offer his analysis of current events. On Thursday, we look forward to talking with several representatives of the Kenosha Writers Guild. They have just published a collection of some of their works called Undertow. Friday's morning show is going to include a preview of a hilarious comedy, which is being presented right now at the Racine Theater Guild, a comedy that actually opens tonight called Boing Boing. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock, and you can find